Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about food television.
Yeah. Food TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've said on the show before, but I have never been into food TV. I had like four stations growing up. Four television stations.
Uh-huh.
And when I got to college and there was cable, I went all in on cartoons. Cartoons like SpongeBob and Comedy Central.
Ah, yeah. Nothing else. That was it.
And Jurassic Park on AMC, even though I own the DVD.
Oh, there's something really satisfying about it being on
it's
a channel.
Like you caught it.
Yeah.
Yes. I'd be at the gym. Then you could take a break during the commercials.
Right. Mm. Oh, I love that about a commercial.
But yeah, now in the age of streaming, it's like horror all the way and comedy. I'm on either end of the spectrum.
And some comedy is a little bit horrific, and some horror is very comedic. So I feel like horror and comedy are two sides of the same coin here.
Isn't it basically release?
Yeah.
Like it's a release of tension.
Yeah, there are a lot of theories about this that we could go into on probably a whole different series.
But, you know, the interesting thing is one of the reasons I don't like food television, and I haven't seen a lot, so, like, this is not a sweeping generalization, but the stuff I have seen, because it was too tense.
Oh, like all the competition shows?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I can't really watch those. I get too worried for them. Like, it's like watching ice skating. It's too much. Like, that's just,
exactly.
Like, it's really beautiful, but I'm also like, oh, no.
The one with the kids? I'm like, don't be mean to the kids. But I have heard Great British Bake Off, one of the reasons people love it is because it's so, like,
yeah, they're pretty sweet to each other,
right.
In general. Definitely watch the holiday episodes from Christmas. Like, oh, it was so dear. Anyway, we had cable growing up most of the time, and I did watch a lot of Food Network when it came out. I had always watched cooking shows on like PBS, like Julie Child, stuff like that. I grew up with so, Iron Chef was like a revelation to me when I was a teenager. So,
yeah.
So all of that, but I still would say that food documentary is one of my largest consumption.
Oh, really?
Of television. Yeah. Yeah. Chef's Table is terrific. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Yeah. I just recently rewatched, I think it's Making Fun of Chef's Table. No, it's Making Fun of Gio Dreams of Sushi, the documentary now episode.
Oh,
it's Making Fun of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But one of the reasons we want to talk about food television is that it's something that a lot of our interviewees on these kind of food field trips have brought up, like in New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
In Nashville.
We'll be talking to a chef and we'll say, how did you get into this? And usually it's like, well, my parents cooked or there was this farm that I grew up on. But right up there is Food Network.
Yeah, and sometimes it's kind of a combination of both.
Yeah.
And especially, I think we've mentioned this in, it was a couple of episodes ago, but that for middle America, where there might not have been that many options, restaurant options, when Food Network or whatever food television came into their town, it exposed them to things they had never been exposed to before. And then that kind of led a push to...
Yeah, yeah. That cultural literacy makes people curious to try something and, you know, allows that kind of genre to grow.
Yeah, exactly. And when we went to Boudin Bourbon and Beer, which is this annual charity event hosted by Emeril Lagasse Foundation, I personally was struck by the fact that Emeril Lagasse and the guest chef Guy Fieri, they are celebrities.
Yeah, yeah. They had like crowds around them at all times, like people wanting to shake their hand.
Yeah. People were cheering. They like came out and made speeches and everybody went wild. And this... I think we said it took place in the area outside of Mercedes-Benz Stadium. So it was a big
event. Oh, yeah. It was a large event.
And people were there to see
these dudes
and the other chefs and try food. But, like, it was a big draw.
It was.
We got excited, too.
I did.
Yes. So I suppose all of this brings us to our question.
Food TV.
What is it?
Sometimes televisions talk about food.
Ooh, now that's a horror movie. If your TV is like talking to you.
Yeah, no, that's Videodrome. We probably don't want to go there. It's TV programming, you know, has to be about something. And food is one of the things it's about.
That is true. And numbers, there are some numbers to show that people are into this. A Harris poll from 2010 found that 8 out of 10 Americans watch cooking shows at least rarely, and half watch them occasionally or more. Only 21% reported never watching cooking shows, which blew my mind.
Wow, yeah.
What?
That's a large,
That's a big amount, as they say. more than half of the viewers also say that they have been inspired to purchase something based on what they saw on a cooking show.
Ah.
Yeah, like a lot of kitchen gadgets.
Sure.
Or ingredients.
Specific ingredients, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The rise of the celebrity chef has coincided with a sharp decrease in staying home to cook. It's created this idea that food is entertainment, it's art, it's an experience, and it's best left to the professionals.
I'd say, well, yeah, we can get into it. But yeah, yeah, about 50-50. Like some food programming is like, no, get in the kitchen and cook. It's totally easy. You can do it. And the other is like, look at this rock star. You will never attain their total skill.
Yes, yes. I would agree. Because this is based on a survey I found. When I read that, I was like, really? I would have thought kind of the opposite. But yeah, I suppose if you're like, you know what? I don't want to cook with, what's that thing? Polenta. That's something I experienced. I guess I'll just go to a restaurant, have them cook the polenta. On the flip side, it has elevated the career of chef and increased the number of people pursuing it as a career. At least it's hard to imagine the exposure to the world through food TV hasn't had any impact on the higher number of folks looking to turn cooking into a career. It's kind of hard to directly correlate it. But
yeah, I think it's there.
Yes, absolutely. So those are the basic of the what.
Uh-huh.
But what about the history?
Ooh.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of it, as it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah, there really is. For as long as the television has existed, there have been cooking shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. The idea of celebrity chefs goes back a bit further to folks like Alexis Soyer, Auguste Escoffier, and Marie-Antoine Carême, and they are all deserving of future episodes.
Absolutely.
And those over-the-top banquets that treated food as entertainment and spectacle, we've talked about those before.
Mm-hmm.
Before food TV, there was food radio.
Oh, yeah. And now I want to do a whole episode on food radio and podcasting.
we'll get into recursive, like, we'll never escape the loop.
That will be our final episode.
And then we'll just live in the studio from then on out.
From then on, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in brief, because I do think it's important for understanding how food TV happened, food radio. So, technology-wise, radio broadcasting got its legs in the 1920s. The tech had existed since about 1910, but had been mostly used as two-way communication by militaries and was largely shut down to the public during World War I. But after the war, broadcast radio grew really quickly. It's an amazing story of how fast technology can spread and develop. Like, you went from people crafting homemade receivers in 1920 to millions of listeners tuning in via store-bought sets by 1923.
Wow.
Which was the same year that the first ads might have started airing. One of the first was from Procter & Gamble for Crisco.
Huh. I just ran into a Crisco cooking book like yesterday.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. I believe it.
We grew up with a vat in my kitchen when I was a kid.
Really?
Oh, yeah. early food radio shows were based in the movement of home economics, like practical cooking and home advice aimed towards women. The programs that stuck with audiences tended to feature like friendly, confidence-inspiring personalities. The first popular food radio show was French. One Dr. Edouard de Pomillon, I'm sorry, I probably just butchered that, even though Annie just did it for me. He began broadcasting his recipes and kitchen stories in 1923 on Radio Paris. He was a food scientist at the Pasteur Institute. For a taste of his work, you can check out the book Cooking with Pomillon. Oh, I got it right that time. Excellent. Doing everything. The first big-time food show in the United States was hosted by someone who our friend Alex Williams just texted us a photo of over the weekend, Betty Crocker. Well, it was a painting because she's fictional, So.
Yeah. No. My world crumbles around me. That actually was the Crisco cooking book. He was showing it to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
cool. It's really cool.
Oh, I believe you. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Future conversation. This show, The Betty Crocker Cooking School on the Air, started in Minnesota in 1924, went national by 1926, and would continue airing all the way through the 1940s. 13 actresses across the country portrayed Betty Crocker, giving tips and answering common questions.
13.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. In response to the rationing during World War II, the UK Ministry of Food launched a radio show called The Kitchen Front in 1940 with the goal of teaching listeners how to make healthy, tasty meals with what was available to them.
Betty Crocker broadcast a program called Our Nation's Rations during the war over here as well. And these and other shows during this time really reinforced the role of women as homemakers. They were an easy pitch to both government and private broadcasters alike because sponsors loved them. So easy to tie in products.
Yeah.
But, okay, this just about brings us to television. But first, it brings us to a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, while all of this was going on, the world saw the beginnings of broadcast television in the mid-1930s. Early programming tended to first be broadcasts of live sporting events, then studio shows based on radio shows, like actors reading from scripts in front of microphones or hosts interviewing celebrities or cooking demonstrations. Audiences would be small for about 20 years, though. As of 1950, only 9% of American households had a TV set.
Wow.
The first ever food show on television may have been in the UK via BBC television in June of 1946, starring one Philip Harbin. It was called simply Cookery.
To the point.
He had been doing cooking shows on the radio since 1942, but apparently was pitching to get on TV the whole time. The CBC says that he was obsessed with this new medium and just, like, wanted to be a part of it. He did have a background in restaurant cooking, so it's like, you know.
He wasn't just some guy off the street.
Well, I mean, he kind of was. But,
okay. But at least he was a cooking guy off the street.
Exactly.
Okay.
The first ever broadcast recipe was for lobster vol-au-vent.
Ooh. Fancy.
Right? Harbin would be a staple on television through the 1960s, towards the end of his life.
The early years of food television shows in America were dominated by PBS, mm-hmm. and by shows that aimed to teach viewers how to cook. The first was a segment that James Beard appeared in. Elsie presents James Beard in I Love to Eat from August of 1946 to 1947. And you can see our James Beard episode for more on that.
It was Elsie presents as in like Elsie the cow, like
what?
Like the mascot from Borden, like Borden's Elsie. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway.
I did not put that together. That's pretty great. It is worth mentioning again for this episode, James Beard was an actor as well and once said, food is very much theater.
Oh, I love that. This was also basically the first broadcast show that focused on cooking and eating as like a pleasurable pastime rather than from a more purely technical and practical standpoint. And he'd be one of only a handful of hosts to approach the topic that way for a long time. Another one, although less well-known these days than James Beard, being James Beard, also began in 1947 and lasted a lot longer than Beard's show because Beard just never really worked on camera. He was pretty awkward back in the day. Dione Lucas, who was one of Cordon Bleu Paris's first female graduates, hosted this primetime cooking show for about a decade. And this, it being primetime, was unusual because most food shows aired during the day. Because it was in the evening, hers was one of the first food shows that many Americans ever saw. And her cooking was ambitious and precise and made for being enjoyed. Also, largely French.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Child would later call her the mother of French cooking in America.
Oh.
Yeah. Also in 1947, the world got what may have been its first commercial network television series, like not on PBS, right, yeah. A series on a privately owned TV network instead of a public one. And it was a cooking show, heavily sponsored by a brand. It was called In the Kelvinator Kitchen.
Oh, my goodness.
And its host was this former opera singer and talk show host, Alma Kitchell. And she would demonstrate Kelvinator appliances and how they could help the average housewife save time in the kitchen.
I know it's not true, but I wish she was, like, singing an opera about it the whole time.
I don't think she was. No. That would have been way better. Mm. If we have a time machine, this is the first stop.
To the Kelvinator Kitchen.
A lot of American cooking shows through the 1950s were along these lines, like just really reinforcing the post-war American dream of convenience and conformity. And post-war gender stereotypes. Like, most hosts were women who were packaged as being homemakers, even though they weren't, they were working. And most male hosts tended to be restaurateurs or chefs. Some contained, like, scripted sketches with other actors interacting with the host, portraying a family. And others would contain segments on, like, housekeeping and fashion. And toward the end of the decade, like, travel and politics, too, which I find interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Many of these shows were only regionally broadcast in the area in which they were filmed. Shows at the time tended to be taped live, like beginning to end, on a single camera and broadcast more or less exactly as they were taped. Like, also, no one really thought to preserve those tapes after they were aired, so we don't have footage of a lot of these early programs. Toward the end of the 1950s, the networks seemed to decide that cooking and home economics shows weren't particularly worthwhile. Certainly, their formula for them, this formula, was not working out very well.
Right. But then we get Julia Child. She made her television debut in 1963 on PBS with The French Chef. It was a regional PBS. Mm-hmm. And you can see our Julia Child episode for more on that.
Briefly, Julia offered progressive American audiences, like, the perfect thing at the perfect time, like just as social mores were changing to encourage people, and perhaps particularly women, to find more genuine pleasure in their lives instead of trying to just, like, wring joy out of duty. And just as the shine of all of these convenience foods was starting to wear off and people were beginning to be more concerned about health and the environment, and just as the aspirational Kennedys were moving into the White House with their fancy French chef,
right.
All of this was happening, and then Julia Child comes along and starts showing people how to attain this aspirational food with whimsy and humor and this sort of, like, friendly practicality.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the combination of a booming post-war middle class and rapidly developing technology meant that most families could afford a TV set. By 1960, 90% of homes had at least one.
Wow, that's a big change.
I know. Oh, yeah, and just poised on the brink of all of that, Child really did help change the way that Americans thought about food, like how and what they cooked, and also how they thought about professional cooks. She helped uplift the profession of chef in the public eye.
We get Joyce Chen of Joyce Loves to Cook. She started her show on PBS in 1966.
Joyce Chen and Julia Child shared the same set.
Oh, yeah?
Julia Child was, like, a foot taller than her, so she had to Chen had to wear high heels.
Oh, my goodness.
When she was taping, just in order to reach the countertops. But, yeah, she presented some of the first Chinese cuisine on American television.
In 1969, we get Graham Kerr's The Galloping Gourmet on network television.
And this was maybe the first food show to focus on entertainment over teaching. Like, Kerr considered himself a comedian first. He's very English. I think that, like, Austin Powers and maybe the Weasley twins have something to owe him
for
their presentational style.
Interesting.
The show was filmed in Canada, but syndicated internationally. And it actually wasn't his first TV food show. He had gotten a start way back in 1959 on a show broadcast in New Zealand, where he was living at the time, working as a food advisor for the Air Force. The first thing he ever cooked on air was an omelet.
I appreciate that. I have a real difficulty with omelets, I gotta say.
Right? No, I don't. It seems like such a simple thing.
It does.
Mm-hmm. It was like Yeah, there's all sorts
of gestures. We're doing kind of arm movements.
Yeah, it's probably coming through really well.
I think it is.
On audio. Mm-hmm. And omelet was the first thing that Julia Child would ever cook on air, too.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah. And Cher's show was the first cooking show that had a studio audience, and with, like, a camera pointed back at them so that you could cut to reaction shots. The show also featured segments of him traveling to find interesting recipes, and he talked about wine pairings. And those seem, like, really prosaic these days, but, no one had seen that before. It was interesting and new and fresh. His 1970s audiences were, you know, armed with this, like, greater confidence in the kitchen thanks to Julia Child, and were eager to bring that kind of, like, metropolitan urbanity into their homes.
Oh.
Like, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Everyone just wanted a fondue pot.
Ugh.
You just went to a place.
I did.
Are you okay? Is it an okay place? Are you all right?
It's a funny place. My mom always wanted to do fondue on New Year's, and it always went wrong. We tried it, like, every year. She wanted to revive it this year, and I was like, Mom, no. Please.
let it have died in the past.
I should find that fondue pot and make sure it disappears.
I've never done the oil thing successfully. I don't want to try that. No. The cheese thing is fine.
Right, yeah. It's just New Year's is not the time to be doing it. That's all I'm saying. Okay. I don't want to go into it any further.
All right, future painful episode on fondue.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, speaking of segments that were new and fresh at the time, in 1970, the folks working on Eyewitness News for ABC in New York City started doing a segment called Eyewitness Gourmet. They would go to a local restaurant and have the restaurant kitchen prepare a signature dish on camera.
Yeah, that's another thing that seems so, like,
yeah. So, like, yeah, duh, that's of course you do that thing. Right. Like, we've done that thing. But
we have done that thing, yeah.
Through the 70s and into the 80s, though, the faces and dishes featured on television got more multicultural, and there was more of a focus on, like, healthy cooking alongside all of that butter and red meat of the previous decade.
In 1975, What's Cooking, hosted by LaDiva Davis on PBS, for example.
This would become the first nationally syndicated cooking show hosted by an African-American woman. The show's focus was on nutrition and saving money, like a recession was on. But right up there with Child and Care, Davis was just this sparkling personality on air. And she also got to share some Southern family recipes.
Ooh. We get Yan Can Cook, hosted by Martin Yan, premiered in 1978. Rick Bayless's Cooking Mexican debuted that year as well on PBS.
In 1982, Justin Wilson seeded the Cajun cuisine trend that we've been talking about exhaustively in our New Orleans episodes with his national show, Louisiana Cookin'. He had been on local stations for a full decade by that point. And if you remember vaguely from your childhood, either someone you're not sure who, or perhaps like SNL doing a really bad Cajun accent and all, like, I guarantee, like that kind of thing.
Oh.
That's him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was that was part of his whole, like, really playing it up Cajun shtick.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In 1983, Jeff Smith's show The Frugal Gourmet debuted on PBS. This was a show that celebrated local cuisine from all over the world, the history and culture and curiosity of food, like what we can learn about the world and its people from food.
The term foodie was first coined in the 1980s.
The economic boom, the American economic boom of the 1980s brought a few things here. We started getting this expanse in, like, expensive, showy haute cuisine, like this ever-expanding interest in those gourmet foods for the home cook, and a greater focus on the restaurant world and its celebrity chefs like Wolfgang Puck and Jacques Pepin. Alongside that, there was the expansion of cable TV, the introduction of VCRs. you know, instead of being limited to, like, just a few cooking shows on a handful of networks, mostly PBS, which was, like, still really the only network making food shows work at the time. Toward the end of the 80s, viewers could choose from many food shows with niche interests, including a return to homemaking. In 1986, Martha Stewart made her TV debut with Holiday Entertaining with Martha Stewart.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Also of note, many networks by this point were running programming 24 hours a day, which was a big shift from prior eras. I know it sounds silly now. Like, why wouldn't TV be on 24 hours a day? But most stations would shut down at a certain right. point in the evening and come back in the morning.
Yeah, those, like, rainbow bars.
Yeah.
I had a station that did that, one of my four stations.
Aw.
Uh-huh. Which wasn't PBS, wasn't one of them. This about brings us to the early 90s, when a group of media-savvy folks, including Trygve Myhren, which I don't want to give something, but I know somebody with this exact same name, and now I'm kind of, like, suspicious
what?
If he has a double life.
Huh.
I'm on to you, Trygve.
I see you.
We know what you did. Reese Schonfeld, Jack Clifford, and Joe Langan got the idea for a New York City-based cable channel that revolved entirely around food. They didn't have much money, nor much interest in food.
But they did some market research and noted how popular food magazines and cookbooks were and saw the success of PBS's food shows and how low cost they could be to produce and how many marketing tie-ins there was potential for.
Uh-huh. And they quickly realized there was a wealth of eager and affordable talent. When word got out that there was this call for talent around food content, the three of these men, were inundated with tapes. Like VCR tapes.
Oh, yeah.
Tapes.
That was the time.
Yeah, it was the time. Like 180 tapes.
What?
Yeah. They got out the old VCR and spent 3 days watching these tapes, taking notes, post-it notes mapped across the wall like a food conspiracy. When Trygve called up Reese with the proposal for a food network, Reese claims he laughed out loud at the idea and his wife agreed, calling it the stupidest idea she'd ever heard.
Wow.
Yeah. She's Ooh. Like, who watches cooking on TV?
That's ridiculous.
That's silly. Up until almost launch day, the working title for this network was The Cooking Channel. But that name was unavailable. And another unavailable name was The Food Network. So they went with The Television Food Network.
Mm.
And reading accounts from some of the first people that worked there, making pilots and shows, it was chaos. It was new.
Yeah, they tried lots of things. From a show by Robin Leach of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, featuring celebrity guests, to a news-style program covering the food world hosted by Donna Hanover. You know, like Rudy Giuliani's wife?
Oh, I'd forgotten about that nugget.
Yeah.
My brain's like,
unearthing
something.
Mm-hmm. There were some stirrings of future successes, though.
Alton Brown and Curtis Aikens first appeared on the Food Network in 1993, and Bobby Flay made his first appearance in 1995. But no one knew what they were doing, including one Emeril Lagasse, who was tapped twice to make a pilot. Both were terrible. That's not me saying it.
No, that's everybody. That's literally everyone yes. saying that. And this was despite his excellent showing on Julia Child's show Cooking with Master Chefs. Like, together they had like a really natural thing, but they were trying to do a scripted thing with him. It wasn't working out.
Right. But the higher-ups really wanted to work with Emeril, and they thought, let's just do a personality show about him. Emeril, who is a classically trained chef, cooking things like meatloaf. Essence of Emeril was hugely popular. It put Food Network on the map and led to the coining of a three-letter word, BAM. Is that how he does it?
Yeah, that was actually a really good Emeril.
Awesome. Well, I can add it to my impressions list, which I did make. We have an impressions list around the office. I haven't shared it with anybody, but I will.
Great. Excellent.
I will. According to Emeril, BAM was born out of exhaustion. The staff would shoot an entire season in 8 days, 5 episodes a day. BAM was sort of like a wake-up call.
That was going really well. But Emeril and the network really hit big when they put him in front of a studio audience for Emeril Live. Like, it was the whole thing. Like, there was a house band. He did an opening monologue. It was like a night show, but with a stovetop instead of a host desk.
Mm-hmm.
Their CEO at the time, one Erica Gruen, had the idea that the network should be, again, like, more about showing viewers a fun time than particularly teaching them anything. She, by the way, was only the second female CEO in the TV industry, TV network industry.
Wow.
Yeah. And all of this was happening around, like, 95 to 97. On sort of the flip side of Emeril Live, one Sarah Moulton hosted a show called Cooking Live, where she took call-in questions and would talk the audience through the full preparation of a recipe. Like, none of this already having your garlic pre-minced in a little ramekin kind of thing. Like, full thing. You could cook along with her in real time, if you so chose.
So, I
just think it's interesting. Like, you've got this rock star thing happening, but there was still room for that, like, PBS-ish, like, person-to-person concept of cooking and teaching.
Yeah. That is interesting.
And other networks were also dabbling in cooking. Take TBS's incredibly bizarre Dinner in a Movie series, which debuted in 1995. If y'all don't remember this, it was surreal. They would have these hosts make something for dinner, intercut in between, like, scenes, like the full movie. Like, it would be like Fast Times from Ridgemont High.
Or Anaconda. I remember Anaconda.
Yeah. And then every, like, 20 minutes, they would stop and be like, yeah, we're dicing onion. And it was so strange.
It was really bizarre.
It was full of puns. All of the dishes had some kind of punny thing to do with the movie anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, TBS at the time.
One of my four stations, so I did get that.
Oh.
BBC got in on all of this as well with Two Fat Ladies in 1996 and Jamie Oliver's The Naked Chef, which debuted in 1997. Jamie Oliver has shared a story of learning that he had a responsibility after he would make a recipe and those ingredients would sell out across the country.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, especially if they were, like, kind of rarer.
Relatively rare, yeah.
Maybe people didn't use them that much, so they weren't in stores. I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And PBS wasn't out of the game either, oh no, with Paul Prudhomme's show Fork in the Road first airing in 1995. Gordon Ramsay got his start around 1999. And side note, I sat next to him at a movie once.
Gordon Ramsay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Was he enjoying himself?
I think so. I was really cold. It had, like, poured down rain and hail.
Oh, no.
It's a whole story.
Oh, goodness.
I'm pretty sure that was him, but I could be wrong. And I also stayed at the hotel The London, which, like, even the breakfast menu is by him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and you can make free phone calls to London.
Oh, where is it located?
Los Angeles, and there is one in London. I think there's one in New York, too. But I was like, who could I call? And I couldn't think of anybody. I do have a friend in London, but I don't know her number. So.
Oh.
Yes. Another side note, I am in an episode of Restaurant Impossible.
Oh.
Or I've never seen it, so I might not have made, like, the cut. Because I thought we were filming the after, but we were filming the before.
Oh, so, when everything is supposed to be terrible?
Exactly. So I thought we were in the after part, so I was like, this is all great. I love it. I love everything. And clearly, Robert Irvine was not happy with me. And then he yelled at me because I wouldn't stop drinking the water. After he announced he'd found a dead cockroach in the ice machine, but I was like, I'd already been drinking the water. Like, the damage is done.
The damage is done. There's not, like, more cockroach. I mean, it's really
exactly.
Just,
yeah. Come on. And I also almost died, slight exaggeration, of choking on a piece of broccoli, and the cameraman just, like, went down with me. I was like, and he's following me. The camera, like, I'm going to die on this episode of Restaurant Impossible.
But it would have been so dramatic.
It would have been. It would have been.
Wow. I wonder if he thought you were acting.
Maybe, because that is one thing. A lot of people there were actors. I don't know if they specifically looked for actors. I was just there for a free meal. It was college. And
oh,
I heard
yeah.
There was, like, a free food thing happening.
You're
I was like, oh, there's
in.
TV.
Done.
Yes.
Around this time, the late 90s, early 2000s, there were so many different shows, like one for every type of cook, every type of eater. And I think more aimed towards the eater than the cook.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that.
In 2000, the Food Network began syndicating a dubbed version of the Japanese cooking competition show Iron Chef, which originally aired in 1993 through 99 over in Japan. It was a wild hit. Like, within a year, its viewership had outpaced Emeril Live's.
Wow.
We, as it turns out, I think that we have Iron Chef to thank and or blame for cooking competition shows in America and thus probably the world. We'll have to do a whole episode there. Within a decade, though, Food Network alone had 16 cooking competition shows.
Yeesh. Oh, my gosh. Some of the Food Network's chefs did become these celebrities. They opened hotels and restaurants bearing their name. Or not, but people knew. Mm-hmm. People knew in Las Vegas, New York, all over.
It was the era of the burgeoning era of reality television. But before the internet had brought us streaming video, traditional television was still huge, and its stars even huger-er. In 2001, Rachel Ray's 30-Minute Meals debuted her first show. The same year, Emeril got a sitcom.
He had a sitcom.
It really did poorly. It did so poorly.
I'm having a hard time imagining anything else than it doing poorly. And that's no slight on you, Emeril.
No. Dude, Emeril, if you're listening, nothing but respect. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do well on a sitcom.
I wouldn't purposefully do well. It would have to be some kind of crazy accident.
See, I want to see a sitcom about that.
an accidental sitcom?
A sitcom about you accidentally being really good on a sitcom.
I mean, I'm available. I got this whole podcasting thing, but outside of that, you know, I'm open to ideas.
Anthony Bourdain's first show, A Cook's Tour, came out in 2002 following the success of his book, Kitchen Confidential. The show wasn't a huge success. I think that he butted heads with the network execs at Food Network. But it did help push off the food travel segment of the food TV industry.
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, Food Network was rated number one among all TV networks, like broadcast, cable, and satellite, quote, in terms of having well-liked hosts and personalities.
Hmm, wow.
In 2005, when they launched the competition show The Next Food Network Star, they received 10,000 audition tapes.
10,000?
Yes. I mean, I was prepared to think that 180 was a large number.
Yeah,
and it was.
Too. Yeah.
But I'm like, oh.
10,000?
Yeah. Oof. Guy Fieri won.
He what?
The Next Food Network Star, the second season in 2006. And yeah, that is how we got Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives in 2007.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Me? I think I did somewhere in a very sure. dim corner of my brain.
Yeah. Got dislodged.
Yeah. That same year, 2007, Rachel Ray joined the ranks of Madame Tussauds in New York City.
That's success right there.
She's a wax statue now. You can go. I don't know if you can still go see it. Yeah. I know that they rotate them, you know.
Yeah. I'm not sure she was there when I went in 2005.
Might have been another dim corner situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, no, in 2005, no, she would not have been there.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. The success of the Food Network spawned so many more cooking shows and even an entire genre of baking and dessert shows, like, separately. The Great British Bake Off, which most of my friends are in love with. Mm-hmm. They've been campaigning for us to do an episode on it, so
okay.
Forthcoming.
Okay.
And the introduction of streaming services has only increased accessibility and content.
Of course.
So much.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness. And yeah, just, I mean, going down to you know, your average human person putting a show up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Getting so many hits. There's so many amazing YouTubers doing food content.
Right.
And it makes me so happy to see just these very strange niche things.
Yeah, the nerd baked goods one. Because of course I do.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one. I really enjoy You Suck at Cooking.
yeah.
But I don't know. That falls into that comedy horror kind of vortex.
Yeah, the comedy horror food intersection. I got you. We have a little bit more for you, but first we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So we do have some issues we wanted to touch on briefly just because it did come up a lot during this research.
Yeah, during research, right. Yeah. And I think that all of this kind of full episodes that we have time to explore
right.
more about these cultural points. But
yes. So one of the comparisons I saw over and over again researching this episode, and I heard while I was at the Southern Foodways Alliance conference in Birmingham, the symposium, was between food TV and porn. And I wasn't even going to bring it up, but it kept coming up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was a whole – one of my main resources for this episode is a book that I'm pointing at as though that makes a difference to y'all called Watching What We Eat, The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows by one Kathleen Collins. And, yeah, she has, like, a couple of chapters about the comparisons between food television and pornography.
Yeah, and, I mean, we even say food porn.
Right, sure.
Right. And – one of the interesting slash sad things about it is, and again, we should do a whole episode on this, but there was a couple of comparisons of people who have eating disorders and will watch food television shows.
Like instead of eating.
Instead of eating.
Yeah.
And kind of like imagine what it would be like. And there's a comparison to porn there as well.
Uh-huh.
There's also the repositioning of chef and cook into this sexy rock star thing that glamorizes the hard life of a chef. And that was something that came up at this symposium I went to about how that kind of leads to some mental health issues or substance abuse issues, or it exacerbates them.
It contributes to it, absolutely. I think that there's already a that kind of like we're all rock stars, we are leading the party kind of emotion that happens in kitchens. And mm-hmm. then when you get someone up there like your Tony Bourdains of the world, then it's like, oh yeah, like that. Well, that I could be driving a Rolls. Like why? Like you know.
Right. Exactly. And then. There is the industry as a whole and the world, but since we're a food show, this industry has faced backlash for its lack of diversity and representation. The expectation that women on cooking shows should wear sexy clothes. There's even a term for it. There's an old Sminty Stuff Mom Never Told You episode about it, but it's basically like the certain neckline that women wore. And of course, sexual harassment scandals, like with Mario Batali, which as of today, as of we're recording this, he's given up all of his steaks in his restaurants due to the sexual harassment scandal around him. So there are these big issues that have arisen from this kind of celebrity chef food thing. It's not, of course, it's in all kinds of industries. It's not just this one.
But. Oh, sure. Yeah. But it's really, I think that it, this, and this is where I sound like a Vulcan. I think it's very interesting that this intersection between the entertainment industry and the food industry, where individually these issues existed in different ways and the ways that they're combining into like the worst Voltron ever in some of the food entertainment industry. It's not like a problem particular to what we're, you know, to the food entertainment industry. But I just think that it's a very fascinating phenomenon that absolutely deserves a lot more thought and research.
Right. And one more thing from me before we close out, that symposium I went to, it touched on a lot of these. It was really great, but it was interesting to hear people from within the industry addressing these problems, like wrestling with them. What do we do? What services can we provide to people in our industry to protect them and to make sure that they're healthy and whole? And it was really inspiring to hear the solutions people were batting around or things that people have already done and tried. So definitely worth coming back to in the future.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, that's our whirlwind.
Yeah. Just ending the episode on this.
On there's hope. There is.
People are certainly aware that these are problems. Especially again to invoke the name of Anthony Bourdain.
Right.
You know, especially in the wake of his suicide, I think that there's been a lot of really important and moving towards really good work in helping people get the help that they need.
Yeah, and just conversation around it. I was kind of surprised that the symposium was 2 days, and I would say almost the entirety of the second day was devoted to things like this.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it was really great. Really great. But that brings us to the end of this episode.
Uh-huh.
And to listener mail. It's like bam.
Like bam.
You got to do the hand motion. I hope that you captured it on mic, but you know. All right. Chad wrote, I recently listened to the episode on energy drinks and it brought back a hilarious science-related memory. Back when I was in 9th grade and during the annual science fair project week, my best friend decided to make his project revolve around the consumption of energy drinks. More specifically, he had 3 of us athletes drink copious amounts of caffeine and then would test our blood pressure at random intervals throughout the rest of the afternoon. I specifically remember that I had the highest dosage of energy drinks, which consisted of drinking 5 cans of Red Bull in one sitting.
Oh, my goodness.
Ooh, ooh. This was much higher than the lowest dose of 3 cans of Mountain Dew. I would say so. And it is safe to say that I was a little jittery for the rest of the afternoon. I even got kicked out of my student government class for being disruptive. To top things off, that week at the science fair, my friend got an earful regarding his project from the visiting medical group commander from the local Air Force base, who happened to be one of the judges. Although my friend didn't place very well in the competition, and I still probably haven't come down from that high all these years later, it still gives me a chuckle when I think about this project. I'm happy you're alive, sir.
Oh, indeed.
5 Red Bulls out.
Oh, I drink responsibly. Jeez.
Yes. That's such a funny. I would have done something similar in high school.
Yeah, that sounds very high school. I just got caffeine jitters from reading that, though. So
I know. It's like, let's just drink a lot of energy drinks and see what happens. That's our science project.
Naomi wrote, I was listening to your The Door-Stopping Story of Fruitcake episode and loved every second. Oh, thank you. My mom's family is English and Scottish, so she makes Christmas cake every year. It's become a family tradition for everyone to stir the cake at least once for that secret ingredient of love. She's thinking about not making one this year because no one eats them anymore, which is a bit upsetting and makes me feel a little bad for not liking them, but fruitcake is really not my thing. But not to be outdone, her older brother makes a Christmas pudding every year as well, and of course we set it on fire. It's always the best part of the day, but doesn't always go off without a hitch. One time my cousin was pouring the brandy over the pudding, and my uncle was a little too enthusiastic about lighting the pudding up, and she didn't get her arm away quick enough. Yeah, the flame managed to jump up to the mug that had the brandy in it, and then up her arm. Thank goodness we're in Australia, so it was about 35 degrees and she wasn't wearing sleeves or her shirt might have caught fire. But that didn't happen.
Good.
She was just a little traumatized and she now stands far, far away from the pudding when her dad gets out the lighter.
Entirely fair. Entirely fair.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's legit. That's a good safety tip.
You know, yeah. I think I'm going to stand back from now on. I love this. So much. Why do we love lighting things on fire?
It's great.
It is. I mean, I'm part of it, too.
I know. Oh, I know.
We won't talk about that. Well, if you would like to email us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you so much, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.